One of the things that I'm just continually awed by is the great courage and tenacity of the people in Myanmar.
The UN Special Rapporteur for Myanmar on their fight for freedom. This is Friday, February 19th, and this is VOA Asia. I'm Ira Melman. You can find us online at VOA Asia Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, and YouTube. Also ahead, Facebook says it will not pay for Australian news. The U.S. starts operating mass COVID vaccine sites. Canada places a barrier for cruise ships to Alaska. The Japan Olympics has an Olympian now running things. That and more on today's VOA Asia. Tom Andrews, the U.N. Special Rapporteur for Myanmar, says the country's youth have had a taste of freedom and they're not going to give up trying to reverse the military coup in their country. He spoke with VOA's United Nations correspondent Margaret Bashir, praising their actions during days of mass protests throughout the country. Myanmar's military, the Tatmadaw, seized power on February 1st, declaring a year-long state of emergency and detaining de facto leader Aung San Suu Kyi and President U Win Mint, among others.
But one of the things that I'm just continually awed by is the great courage and tenacity of the people in Myanmar. And I'm really impressed with the young people. I was told, look, many have learned about life under the Tatmadaw, in an authoritarian military regime, from their parents and their grandparents. And they have had a taste of freedom, of what it is like to have privacy, to have human rights, such as the right to express oneself freely and freedom of association. The right to run for office, the right to choose who you'd like to serve in office. And so these young people are not going to give this up. And, I've been told, look, we've heard the stories from our parents, from our grandparents, and we're not going back there. And we're going to do everything we can to make sure that we don't. And so the savviness that they have with the use of the internet, the creative tactics that they're employing, both online and offline, shutting down military convoys heading into demonstrations by having their cars suddenly break down in the middle of the street. And suddenly there's many cars breaking down in the middle of the street. And so so they're using a variety of these techniques. They're being very creative. It is remarkable to watch them, and it truly is awe-inspiring. We so often just talk about this in analytical terms and often in geopolitical terms, but these are real human beings. These are real young people who are sacrificing everything and risking everything to fight for their future. And so I hope that that's a part of the story that people hear, and that's a courage and a tenacity that people recognize. It's really the heart and soul of what this is about.
Andrews urged the international community to continue to speak up about Myanmar, to implement targeted economic sanctions and an arms embargo, and to support the protesters who, he said, need to know they're not alone. Protesters were out again across Myanmar on Thursday. The daily protests and strikes that have paralyzed many government offices show no sign of easing, despite appeals by the junta for civil servants to return to work and threats of action if they don't. Libby Hogan reports.
The Myanmar military issued arrest warrants for six celebrities who were accused of encouraging civil servants to strike and join the protest against this month's coup. The strikes have paralyzed many government offices and businesses, but one name on the warrant list, actor Lu Min, posted defiantly on his Facebook page that, quote, "It's amazing to see the unity of our people. People's power must return to the people." Despite junta appeals for civil servants to return to work and threats if they do not, there has been no sign of the strikes easing. Motorists in Yangon also continued with a campaign to show their opposition to the coup by driving at a snail pace throughout downtown traffic on Thursday. Last night, in the country's second largest city, Mandalay, Security forces opened fire with rubber bullets on railway workers who had gone on strike earlier in the week. That's according to local residents. And one charity worker was wounded in the leg. Neither the army nor the police made any immediate comment on the incident, but the army's Facebook page said forces were providing security and, quote, to make sure people have tranquility and sound sleep. Nearly 500 people have been arrested for taking part in the protests.
Reuters' Libby Hogan reporting. You can learn more about what's happening in Myanmar by checking our many digital platforms, including voanews.com. These are among the top Asia headlines you'll find right now at voanews.com. The U.S. charges three North Korean computer programmers with stealing more than $1 billion through numerous cyber attacks on financial institutions and other companies. Hong Kong's government has given employees at public broadcaster RTHK a deadline to decide whether to sign an oath of loyalty to the Chinese Special Administrative Region. Hong Kong's High Court denies another bail application to media tycoon and Beijing critic Jimmy Lai. Nearly 100 asylum seekers are among 1,200 Myanmar nationals Malaysia plans to send home next week. South Korea will double its supply of syringes for its COVID-19 vaccine program. Expanded coverage of these stories and more are on Facebook at VOA Asia and on the voanews.com website. This is VOA Asia. Facebook is blocking Australian users from sharing or viewing news content amid a dispute over a proposed law. Australia wants tech giants like Facebook and Google to pay for the content reposted from news outlets. From Sydney, Phil Mercer reports.
A bombshell decision is how Facebook's move is being reported in Australia. The social media giant said it was banning Australians from sharing and reading news stories on its platform with a heavy heart. The government in Canberra, though, has said it won't back down. Ministers have said the Facebook ban highlighted the immense market power of these digital social giants. About 17 million Australians visit Facebook every month. The Media Bargaining Code legislation has already been passed by the lower house of the Australian Parliament and is expected to receive final approval by the upper chamber, the Senate, next week. It would make Australia the first country to force big tech firms to pay for news content. Communications Minister Paul Fletcher is scathing about Facebook's actions.
Facebook needs to think very carefully about what this means for its reputation and standing. They're effectively saying on our platform there will not be any information from organisations which employ paid journalists. They're effectively saying any information that is available on our site does not come from these reliable sources.
The progress of Australia's social media laws is reportedly being closely followed in other parts of the world, including Canada and the European Union. Facebook said the legislation fundamentally misunderstands the relationship between itself and publishers. Large technology companies, including Google, have argued that by using stories from other publishers, they generate more internet traffic and revenue for the websites run by traditional media outlets. They've complained that as their advertising revenues have collapsed, social media platforms have benefited from their quality journalism without paying for it. In contrast to Facebook, Google has this week signed multi-million dollar deals with three major Australian broadcasters and publishers. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
Happening now in Asia, Indonesia's capital of Jakarta is threatening residents with fines of up to 5 million rupiah for refusing COVID-19 vaccines, an unusually stiff penalty aimed at ensuring compliance with a new regulation making inoculations mandatory. Stay up to date with VOA. You're listening to VOA Asia. Thank you for being with us on VOA Asia. I'm Ira Melman. President Joe Biden's administration has pledged to improve the delivery of COVID-19 vaccines in the U.S., This week, the first federally supported mass vaccination sites opened in California. Matt Dibble has more.
Cars pour into Oakland, California's Sports Arena parking lot this week. Not for a baseball game, but for COVID-19 vaccinations. The Oakland location and another in Los Angeles are the first mass vaccination sites in the nation to be supplied and staffed by the U.S. federal government as part of President Biden's 100 Sites in 100 Days initiative. Tammy Luttrell is the regional administrator with the Federal Emergency Management Agency.
Our goal is to vaccinate up to 6,000 per day. We have over 600 employees who are working at this location, and they're working 7 days a week, 10 hours a day, to be able to reach as many people as possible.
The Federal Emergency Management Agency, also known as FEMA, is overseeing operations at the new sites in partnership with a wide array of state and local agencies and the military. The sites were erected in little over a week, signaling a new urgency in the U.S. response to the disease. California, the most populous state, also has the most COVID-19 deaths. It has struggled to maintain a steady supply of vaccines. Last week, a number of inoculation sites were forced to temporarily close because of vaccine shortages. Officials explained that the new FEMA sites are not competing with states, but adding a new source of doses. Both California locations were chosen for their proximity to the African American and Latino communities most impacted by the disease. Similar mass sites are planned to open in Texas and New York in coming weeks. Matt Dibble for VOA News, Oakland, California.
After you listen to VOA Asia, see it. VOA Asia is on YouTube. See and share the fun with Food Bites, our weekly culinary dive into foods from the homeland. Recipes that came with chefs who immigrated to the United States. Students enrolling in U.S. schools can get their first lessons about life on campus. Subscribe for free and see us often on VOA Asia YouTube.
This news from VOA Asia. New research shows air pollution caused tens of thousands of deaths in the world's five most populous cities last year, despite coronavirus lockdowns, urging governments to ditch fossil fuels and invest in a green recovery. All of the big stories come your way through the day on VOA Asia Twitter and Facebook. This is VOA Asia. This is Business Scene. I'm Ira Melman. Foreign investors once flocked to Myanmar as it began its democratic transition a decade ago. However, the nation's military coup is now likely to speed up a trend of Western withdrawal with China's expansion. The nation of over 50 million people had its untapped potential up for grabs in 2011 when its military leaders started to loosen their grip. This sparked investors to pump money into various fields such as telecommunications, infrastructure, manufacturing, and construction projects. But after a military crackdown on Rohingya in Rakhine State led to allegations of genocide in 2017, the buzz started fading away for Western investors. In the aftermath of the recent coup, U.S. President Joe Biden has threatened to reintroduce economic sanctions that were removed in 2016. The European Union is also considering an economic embargo which could put the country's rag trade industry at risk. Wana So, a shopkeeper in Myanmar, is worried about the country's future after the coup.
Due to the coup, international economic sanctions will become a possibility in the future, and it'll definitely happen. Myanmar people have already been facing COVID-19 and have been living under difficult conditions. The people will suffer when it comes to economic sanctions due to the coup.
However, analysts predict Myanmar will not face any economic blowback from their top trading partners, China, Hong Kong, Singapore, and India. Residents throughout Asia are celebrating the Lunar New Year with largely outdoor activities. In one of Hong Kong's busiest neighborhoods, Causeway Bay, the area is draped with golden ox statues, red lanterns, and other festive decorations. King Lin, a resident of Hong Kong, explains how people are celebrating the Lunar New Year amid the pandemic.
Because of the epidemic, we have fewer opportunities to get together to have dinner or pay a New Year's call. But we're choosing a healthier lifestyle, like climbing a mountain with friends.
In Macau, many cultural venues are still operating normally during the New Year holidays to provide residents with a variety of fun activities. A leather crafts workshop is being held at the World Heritage Lukau Mansion, attracting many families. An ancient town in southwest China's Chengdu City drew large crowds with traditional Sichuan opera performances and a parade featuring local folk culture. Markets in Taiwan are also buzzing with the travel ban in place when residents are forced to shop local, making all their holiday purchases for the Lunar New Year. For Business Scene, I'm Ira Melman. Happening in Asia, the World Health Organization team investigating the origins of the coronavirus wrapped up its 28-day mission to Wuhan, China recently without finding the origin of the virus. Stay with us for the latest news from and about Asia at voanews.com and all of our digital platforms. Canada's cancellation of the 2021 Alaska cruise ship season due to the coronavirus pandemic has angered the U.S. state's politicians and rattled the tourism industry in both countries. Those on the ground in both Alaska and the Canadian province of British Columbia are dealing with the fallout. Craig McCullough reports from Vancouver.
Citing continuing concerns over the COVID-19 pandemic, the Canadian Transportation Ministry has extended the prohibition of any passenger cruise vessels carrying over 100 people between Canada and Alaska. The order extends through February 2022. In a terse statement, Alaska's U.S. congressional delegation complained that the decision was made arbitrarily by Canada with no consultation or advance notice. The statement from the two U.S. senators and the state's only representative also says it was made without any consideration for Alaska or the state's economy. According to the Alaska Travel Industry Association, in 2019, the state welcomed more than 1.3 million visitors who arrived on cruise ships, comprising 60% of the state's summer visitors. The association's CEO, Sarah Leonard, is urging a temporary waiver to the U.S. Passenger Vessel Services Act to allow cruise ships to sail from American ports, like Seattle, directly to Alaska. Adopted in 1886, the Act still prohibits cruise ships from sailing directly between American ports, forcing Alaska-bound vessels to either start from or stop in Canada.
We've long advocated since the beginning of the pandemic for a potential temporary waiver of that federal legislation, which would, again, potentially allow large ship cruise passengers or large ship cruise operations to travel to Alaska.
Vancouver, British Columbia is the principal starting point for most cruise ships heading to ports of call in Alaska, with nearby Seattle providing competition. According to the Port of Vancouver, 2019 was a record-breaking year with more than 288 cruise ship visits, a 22% increase from the previous year. Walt Judas is the CEO of the Tourism Industry Association of British Columbia. He is concerned a temporary waiver to the Passenger Vessel Services Act might become permanent to the detriment of British Columbia's tourism industry.
Once you set a precedent like that, even if only on a temporary basis, who's to stop a lobby from making that permanent? And so that would be a big concern. If you start to sail from, say, Alaska to Seattle and vice versa, and you cut out the Canadian ports, now you've lost a huge amount of business for the visitor economy and for the economy in general. We're talking more than $2 billion in economic impact.
The Vancouver Convention and Visitors Bureau estimates each ship's visit brings at least $2.2 million in economic benefits, including Vancouver hotel bookings before and after cruises. Judas is still hoping, with enough pressure on the Canadian government and positive development in the fight against the coronavirus pandemic, that there might be a way to salvage at least a portion of the cruise ship season this year. Craig McCulloch for VOA News, Vancouver.
We continue on VOA Asia. Japan's Seiko Hashimoto, who has competed in 7 Olympics, has been chosen as president of the Tokyo 2020 Organizing Committee. Olivia Chan reports.
This is the president of Tokyo 2020, Seiko Hashimoto. The 56-year-old politician will be leading the Tokyo Olympics Organizing Committee after ex-Prime Minister Yoshiro Mori resigned from the post over sexist remarks. Hashimoto was born just days before Japan hosted the Summer Olympics in 1964. Her parents named her after the Olympic flame, and she has lived up to that name. Hashimoto took part in 7 Olympic Games, the most Olympic Games any Japanese woman has ever participated in. The highest Olympic medal she won was a bronze at the 1992 Albertville Winter Games in the ladies' 1,500-meter ice skating race. She's also the only Japanese woman to have competed in the Olympics while serving as a lawmaker. After marrying a widower in 2000, she made history again by becoming the first upper house lawmaker to give birth while holding office. Her policy focus has been on education, and she has also prioritized health issues and Japan's falling birth rate. Hashimoto served as the Olympics minister, doubling as minister in charge of women's empowerment, before taking up the post as the Tokyo 2020 president.
Reuters' Olivia Chan. First ladies are not elected, but once their husband becomes president, they're expected to represent the nation and to look good while doing it. Although they have no overt political power, BOA's Dora McCarr reports that modern first spouses have turned to fashion diplomacy to get their point across.
A few hours after becoming First Lady, Jill Biden wore a custom dress and coat embroidered with the official flower of each U.S. state and territory.
The state flower for Delaware was embroidered closest to her heart along the trim of the dress. So she was making, with that fashion statement, I think she was trying to make a statement about unity. Which, of course, has been already one of her husband's main themes as president, unifying the nation.
What a first lady wears is actually very important. Whether it's fair or not is another question, but it's, you know, fashion diplomacy at its peak.
Brower, who has written a book about first ladies, says the president's wife is expected to wear American-made clothing. She also has the power to make a designer's career. That's what happened with Michelle Obama's inaugural look.
Their inaugural gown that she wore, famously the off-the-shoulder white gown, was by Jason Wu, who few people had ever heard of, and she really launched his career.
Brower says first ladies are under pressure to look good but approachable. They're supposed to wear clothes that American women could potentially afford, or at least aspire to own.
When Melania Trump was first lady, she famously wore this $51,000 Dolce & Gabbana jacket, which was, you know, the price of most people's yearly income. And it was just seen as completely out of touch.
Michelle Obama wore plenty of high-priced designers, but she also became known for blending affordable pieces into her wardrobe.
We saw Michelle Obama mixing high and low. You know, she was the mom in chief, so she would wear cardigans from J. Crew with maybe a Carolina Herrera skirt. So I think that first ladies have this real advantage in that they can spotlight designers, but they have a disadvantage in that they can't wear things that are inaccessible because people don't want to see that.
When it comes to Jill Biden, Brower expects to see America's newest first lady wearing clothes that are accessible and affordable to most people, especially now with the pandemic raging.
So please keep wearing your mask.
Dora McQuarr, VOA News, Washington.
You've been listening to VOA Asia. Like us on Facebook, VOA Asia. Follow us on Twitter at VOA Asia. And find us on Instagram and YouTube and at voanews.com. Thank you for joining us. Thanks to our managing editor, Diane Gao, and our VOA Asia team, Jim Stevenson, Keith Lane, Amy Heibel, and Doug Bernard. I'm Ira Melman in Washington. Enjoy the day ahead.